This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's not as though universal coverage is some brand new radical idea. Never mind other countries. Long ago, the United States was this close to adopting it, until a counterassault killed the plan. Jill Quadagno, author of One Nation Uninsured, Why the U.S. Has No National Health Insurance, told us in 2017 that the history of single-payer proposals is the history of scorched-earth lobbying and PR campaigns designed to thwart them.
Really, it goes back 100 years.
In the 1910s, proposed state laws for government health care, chiefly those in New York and California, were getting attention. But the proposals came from the wrong sort.
There were immigrants from Hungary and from Germany, many of them Jewish immigrants, who brought with them socialist ideas. Some of the labor unions had socialist orientations. This was considered a threat.
In the lead-up to World War I, the fight for national health insurance also was caught up in the fear of corrupting our way of life.
When the bill for New York began to make headway, officers of the New York Medical Society called it un-American, not democratic. Their leader said it represented the first step towards state socialism. And so that was really the beginning of this theme that health insurance is socialism. During the New Deal, President Roosevelt had considered including national health insurance in the Social Security Act of 1935, but there was opposition from the American Medical Association in particular that were very vocal about it. And he was not willing to risk losing Social Security for national health insurance, and so he took that out of the bill.
President Truman took up the mantle, and he was famously persistent in trying to achieve single payer.
Most of our people cannot afford to pay for the care they need. I have often and strongly urged that this condition demands a national health program.
In fact, when President Johnson finally signed Medicare and Medicaid into law, he credited Harry Truman.
He had been a judge in a small town. He had seen many of his clients who were sick and poor and couldn't pay for health care. So he had both a personal interest and then a politician's interest in what he thought might be a popular and winning campaign slogan, health insurance for all.
Our ultimate aim must be a comprehensive insurance system to protect all our people equally against insecurity and ill health.
Republicans were very much opposed to the Social Security Act, which they saw as a government takeover.
In the midst of a Red Scare in which everything that looked pink would stink.
If a person supports organizations which reflect communist teachings or organizations labeled communist by the Department of Justice, she may be a communist.
That was right before McCarthy began his hearings, socialism, fascism, Nazism. The American Medical Association has local chapters of physicians in every town who controlled access to hospitals. So if you lost your membership in the AMA, you could be banned from practicing in hospitals. So they had a powerful weapon at their hand to become this huge lobbying force against national health insurance.
In the United States, we're frightened about socialized medicine, and our medical profession is going to do everything possible to prevent the government, the federal government, taking over medicine.
They hired a PR firm called Whitaker and Baxter to devise a campaign against Truman's plan. That included speeches doctors could give in their towns, literature that they could hand out to patients, and so the hospitals and doctors' offices and nurses and dentists became very involved in the fight against national health insurance. But beneath what was visible were the activities of the National Association of Manufacturers, the Chamber of Commerce, and other business groups giving money, supporting candidates. And so many Democratic senators lost their seats for supporting national health insurance. It died a death in the 40s and was not really revived until Clinton, I would say.
Now, the nominal argument by the AMA against national health insurance, as people continue to argue today, is that the government would get between your personal relationship with your doctor and your own agency over your own health.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. Today, the relationship between patient and doctor in this country is something to be envied anyplace. The privacy, the care that is given to a person, the right to choose a doctor, the right to go from one doctor to the other.
But it was never really about that, was it? It was about how much the docs were going to get paid.
Doctors were opposed because they were afraid that if there was a third-party payer involved, that it might take over control of doctors' charges and doctors' practices, which is, of course, what's happened anyway over the last century.
As it turned out, doctors did very well by Medicare. And by the time the Clintons in the early 90s were working on their health care policy, the interference was less from the AMA than the insurance companies themselves, who got together and funded, among other things, this notorious ad that came to be known as Harry and Louise.
This was covered under our old plan.
Oh, yeah, that was a good one, wasn't it?
Things are changing, and not all for the better. The government may force us to pick from a few healthcare plans designed by government bureaucrats.
Having choices we don't like is no choice at all.
Yeah, they choose.
We lose.
And the Harry and Louise ads echoed a theme that began really in the 1930s, the idea that the government would take over your health insurance and would destroy the doctor-patient relationship.
It's a common sense approach that restores the sacred doctor-patient relationship.
And the respect for the doctor-patient relationship.
And returns the relationship between a patient and his or her doctor without the government being in the middle.
What about the hitherto all-powerful epithet, socialized medicine?
You know, that comes and goes in waves, and so I think it will always be a part of American politics. But we find that the younger you are, the more likely you are to support government-provided health care for everyone. For younger people, their whole lives, Medicare has been there. Medicaid has expanded enormously. Medicaid is now almost as popular as Medicare, and so that idea now is resonating with the public much more than the idea that the government doesn't have any responsibility and has to get out of the healthcare system completely. People just don't buy that anymore.
Jill, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Jill Quadagno is the author of One Nation Uninsured, Why the U.S. Has No National Health Insurance. She is also Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Florida State University. Coming up, free money for everyone. No, seriously, this is on the media.